So how they're mathematically represented, the notion of state in different theories, and how those carry with them various philosophical assumptions about the theory, and what we can learn by examining the mathematical representation of the notion of state. And then, so first I'm going to talk about the notion of state space that Andreas talks about a lot and was first introduced in the Eichenbach-Field formulation of Kokesh-Becker. I'm going to talk about some mathematical results that I've been working on in my thesis about how we can consider that to be a geometric notion of space that corresponds to what we think of in classical mechanics, state space or phase space, and why that's the direct mathematical analogy. Quantum mechanics, and then I'm going to show how that relates to the normal notion of state that we have in quantum mechanics of a density matrix, to show how we can recover that notion of space from this other notion, that notion of state space from this notion of state space. Okay? So in classical mechanics, we have this background, this assumption of non-contextual realism that we didn't even realize we were making until 50 years ago. And that allows us to identify two different notions of what a state is in classical mechanics. And there's two ideas of what people mean when they say state. So there's the intuitive idea that the state of a system is its ontological configuration. It's what state, it's what the system, you know, looks like, it's what it is. But that's not how we mathematically represent it generally, because you can't really represent how a system is. You have to represent it in terms of numbers, some sort of mathematical object. And the way we do that is we label the configuration of a system by outcomes, by all the possible outcomes of what happens when you measure it. I mean, that's a very quantum way of looking at it, because those outcomes, if you assume non-contextual realism, those are actually just the physical properties that are inherent to the system, and that by measurement we're just benignly extracting it, those properties, without disturbing them. But in quantum mechanics, we have to make this distinction between what the system is and what are the outcomes when we perform a measurement on a system at a certain state. Because in classical mechanics we have this conflation of these two notions, that allows us to give a geometric description of state space, where we can describe a theory, classical theory, just as a geometric space whose points represent the different possible states of the system, and a state gives definite values for definite predictions for every possible measurement you can do. But because Kokesh-Becker ruled out non-contextual realism in real-world theories, we have to modify this notion of state space in order to account for contextuality. And I'm going to argue that that's what Eichenbach-Field's spectral pre-sheaf does. And I'm going to talk about some mathematical aberrations on that notion of state space, and argue that it's the direct analogy of classical phase space, and then show you how we get back quantum mechanical states. Okay, so the way I'm going to argue that it's a direct analog of classical phase space. So first, I'm going to show that I'm going to discuss how it allows for elegant formulations of the key theorems of quantum foundation. So the Kokesh-Becker theorem was the original application of this formulation of state space. Gliese's theorem, which is something that's new, then that's what I'll talk about. Another big part of my work so far is in taking this construction of the spectral pre-sheaf and the related constructions that have some modified versions of it, and show that it provides a natural algorithmic way of taking any concept in classical geometry or classical physics, any sort of concept that can be defined in terms of a space, and in physics would be the state space, and how that extends, and show that there's an algorithmic method for taking an input, some classical concept, and getting its output, its analogous quantum concept, or in mathematical terms, its non-commutative geometric concept. So I'm going to talk a bit about non-commutative geometry too. And in case a lot of people aren't familiar with what it is, but it's a established field of mathematics that's actively being researched, but it's also quite relevant to quantum mechanics because it sort of describes what the geometry of a non-commutative algebra looks like. And you know, quantum mechanics, we always have these algebras and non-commutative algebras observables, and the corresponding geometry that is studied in non-commutative geometry, albeit abstracted by mathematicians, but concretely in quantum mechanics, it's actually the geometry is that of state space. In a way that's analogous to classical state space, so I'll talk about that. I'm going to apply this algorithm to the notion of classical state, mixed state, for Pauli distribution, and show that as output, when we apply this algorithm for extending classical concepts, we get a density matrix. And this sort of gives a nice picture of Gleason's theorem, as I mentioned, a nice picture of what a density matrix really is. It's basically the same thing as Gleason's theorem, but it's a little bit more, for me at least, it was a bit instructive, intuitive. And that'll show us how to recover the usual notion of state over this contextual outcome space. And it shows us that we can look at a density matrix as being a collection of probability distributions, one for each context, such that they respect marginalization, and that's it. So if you have a quantum state, you can get this distribution for every context. And if you have a distribution of every context which respects marginalization, you can actually recover the density matrix. I mean, that's Gleason's theorem, that's what I'll talk about. So I'm going to start off with some trivialities before moving into a description of non-commutative geometry and how it relates to what I'm going to be talking about. But I want to start out by talking about state observable duality and how that's been studied mathematically. So very generally, a theory of physics is something which takes in as input some physical system. So that could be anything from like a pendulum, an atom, or a galaxy. And part of what a physical theory is specifying that regime of applicability. And it spits out a mathematical model, right? So examples of theories of physics are like classical mechanics, quantum mechanics, GR, etc. So it takes in a physical system and spits out a mathematical model. The mathematical model is a bunch of mathematical structures, for example, manifolds or vector spaces, and some physical interpretations for those mathematical objects. And the reason why we get out these mathematical objects is so that we can use them to actually compute predictions, numerical predictions. So every mathematical model will either explicitly or implicitly, by some fooling around, putting in another form, will always contain a description of two things: all the possible ways that a system can be in, that's distinguishable, and a description of all the quantities that can be measured, that is, observables. So the collection of observables generally has some kind of algebraic structure because they represent quantities. So, quantities are things which can be added and multiplied, and so on. That's why we expect that the collection of observables will have some algebraic structure. And the collection of states generally has some kind of geometric structure. That is, we have a notion of when two states are close together. And that generally corresponds to when they have very similar properties. So if two states generate very, very similar numerical properties, then we consider them close together. I mean, there are lots of different notions of geometries, or algebras, and part of the theory is specifying those. Now, what's common also is that states and observables are always in duality. That is, if you take a pairing of a state and observable, you get some number. That's very natural because a state is something which gives you a number for every observable. And vice versa, an observable is something which gives you a number for every state. And that number is simply the value of the observable when you measure it on a state. Basically, this means that you can consider states to be functions on observables just as well as you can consider observables to be functions on states. So this is very explicit in classical physics, which can be expressed geometrically. You have a state space, which is a set of points with some extra structure. So often it might be something like a symplectic manifold, where the points represent the pure state of the system, and they specify all experimental outcomes with complete precision. And the observables are represented as real value functions on the state space. And they simply map a state to the value of that observable if you measure it on that state. A time evolution is given by a path in this state, in the shape. And the important thing is that you can encode the physical system in terms of its geometry. Now, Kokesh-Becker tells us we can't do this. We don't have, we can't construct such a simple geometry to represent a quantum system as just a simple collection of points with structure. But I think it's an interesting question to ask, what if we allow ourselves some liberty in what we consider to be a geometric space? But the notion of what a geometric space has evolved throughout history considerably, from just a bunch of axioms about triangles to analytic geometry, and then in the last century we have these categorical notions of space where there aren't even a collection of points, that they're characterized in terms of some other notion, some other property of what we expect a geometric space to have. And something, an idea that's gaining steam, especially with the last 100 years in non-commutative geometry, is that a geometric space is some sort of mathematical object that can be studied using geometric tools or intuition. So we have geometric tools or intuition that we have from all of our previous studies of geometry, and even though they don't directly apply to the sort of objects we might want to consider to be spaces, we can still study them using these tools or intuition. And I'll talk about how we do that in non-commutative geometry. The first thing I want to describe, Gelfand duality, which I think is one of the coolest things of the last century, and it's central to understanding state of variable duality in classical mechanics, and also central to understanding non-commutative geometry. So Gelfand duality is an equivalence between categories, and it's equivalence between, forgetting all the little technical that's a technical thing to specify, but it's basically an equivalence between topological spaces and commutative C-star algebras. That's really interesting. It's an algebra, geometry, duality. It's a, and I want to argue that it's actually a state of variable duality. Same idea. So if we have this topological space, we can consider that to be our state space, and consider the commutative C-star algebra to be an algebra of observables. So the way that the equivalence works is that on one way, if we have the state space, and we just take all the continuous complex value functions, so we get a commutative C-star algebra, and we can actually go backwards, because in equivalence, we can recover from commutative C-star algebra its underlying pure state space by taking all the homomorphisms into C. So physically, that's like going from state space to its algebra observables. So the real value functions are actually the self-adjoint elements, right? Because a self-adjoint complex function is actually a real function. And basically going backwards, we're getting an underlying pure state space. But in quantum mechanics, our algebras of observables are non-commutative, which means that this doesn't apply. We can't, because it only applies to commutative C-star algebras. However, because in the commutative case, we have the equivalence between the algebra and the geometry side of it. I mean, there's not really any difference. The algebra is, we can consider the algebra to be a geometry, basically. And we can apply this sort of reasoning to consider the non-commutative algebra variables as also representing a geometry. And that's exactly what mathematicians who study non-commutative operator geometry do. So it's a little bit of a misleading name, because it's not actually in practice geometry. In practice, it's algebra. You're manipulating operator algebras, but with geometric reasoning behind it always. So the essential idea is that, because commutative C-star algebras are always function spaces. They're always represented as some as the space of all functions to see from some topological space. And we just have to use that as a motivating metaphor when we consider non-commutative algebra. We take a non-commutative C-square algebra and we just sort of assume that there's some kind of exotic topological space such that the non-commutative algebra represents the algebra functions from that space to C. Just as any commutative C-square algebra, it's always going to be equal to the continuous value functions in some topological space X, right? When this is commutative. Now we can say, okay, this is non-commutative, but we assume that this still holds in some imaginary space X that actually doesn't exist. And it doesn't exist, you can't construct in terms of points, you can't visualize it, but you can still use this equation as a guiding metaphor to study non-commutative algebra as if it was this geometry. So how do we do this? So we have to use Gell-Fein duality as our central idea, and we use Gell-Fein duality to rewrite every geometric concept that we want to study in terms of the algebra. Because remember that Gell-Fein duality provides an equivalence, so that any geometric concept about topological spaces, we can now push over the duality and turn it into a concept in terms of algebra. So I'll give you a really simple example, open sets. So we have some topological space, and we have some open set, right? And the topological space is some collection of points, the open set is a subset of those points, but we want to describe it in terms of the space X. We want to describe it in terms of this algebra, C of X, right? So how do we do that? We want to characterize this open set U in terms of algebra. Well, we have to describe it in terms of A, and A is are all the functions from the space X to R. So we have to describe, we have to characterize U solely in terms of the algebra functions without any reference to the space itself or the points. So what we do to do that is notice that if I take any function from X to R, right? And I take any function which vanishes outside of U, and I multiply any function f from the whole space with any function that vanishes outside of U, I get another function which also vanishes outside of U. So what this tells me is that all the functions which vanish outside of U form an ideal of A. Okay, can I hear everyone? Go over again, yeah. So that's how we characterize what an open set is. We don't consider the open set to be the collection of points, but yeah.
Isn't that true for like any subset of the space?
No.
No.
Because being equal to zero is a closed condition. Non-equal to zero is an open condition. It's just take the inner symmetry for those points for which it's zero. This gives you a closed subset.
The function like continuous. Well,
okay. Function like continuous.
Yeah. I'm sort of skipping over some of the conditions to make this easier and less boring. But basically, the open sets of this space are in one-to-one correspondence with the closed ideals of the algebra. So we can forget thinking about open sets and just think about ideals of the algebra. But the brilliant thing about this is that ideals, say, talking about them as ideals makes no references to the points of the space. So we don't need a space to talk about what an ideal is. We can talk about an ideal of an arbitrary algebra. So we can now take a non-commutative algebra and talk about an ideal of it as if it was an open set in some imaginary space X, even if there is no space X. So that's how you do it. You just use Gell-Fein duality to rewrite every geometric concept you want in terms of the algebra, and then you can build this crazy dictionary where every geometric concept has an algebraic concept, and the way you build it is basically like doing this, but it's mathematically hard work, right? Because, in order to do this, I had to make the observation about the ideals. It wasn't automatic. There wasn't some algorithm that takes you from this side to that side, you have to have insight and experience to be able to make these sort of leaps from geometry to algebra. But here's an example of very, very basic geometry algebra equivalences. And I think when you see some of these, some things will jump out in terms of their quantum state space, the relevant quantum state space. For example, a continuous real valued function. So you do this always in the commutative case, the point. And so its equivalent is a self-adjoint element. Right? That's quite suggestive. Because remember we talked about continuous real valued functions being observables in classical mechanics, and self-adjoint elements being observables in quantum mechanics. Cartesian product corresponds to the tensor product, so the Cartesian product is how you form the composite of systems in classical mechanics. Tensor product is how you do it in quantum mechanics. The Borel measure corresponds to a positive functional, so a Borel measure is like a distribution over phase space, like a mixed state, and this is the quantum version of that. But basically this dictionary goes on forever, and it's not just topological concepts that you can turn into algebra. You can actually do this for every kind of geometry that's been studied. You can do differential geometry, you can do measure theory, you can turn all those concepts into concepts about your algebra. So, and what you're doing is you're treating non-commutative algebras as if they were geometries, because you're looking at their geometric dual of commutative algebras. But if we were able to extend Galfoyan duality to non-commutative algebras, so take non-commutative algebras and get out a geometry which corresponds in this way, then that's a powerful argument that that's a direct analog of classical state space. So I've been studying the idea that spectral presheaf and related structures can provide this sort of geometric dual to non-commutative algebra. And so one of the ways the way that I chose to attack this question is to try to reconstruct the non-commutative dictionary in a new way. For the non-commutative dictionary, as I mentioned before, you have to take each concept and then study it specifically and come up with some insight as to how you convert that geometric thing into an algebraic thing. But I figured if you actually have a geometric space and saying that this is representing the geometric version of the algebra, then there should be some automatic way of taking in any classical geometric concept, applying it to the space, and just getting out the non-commutative version of it. And so I came up with the recipe for how you might do that. And I'm going to talk a bit about that recipe, and then I'm going to apply it to the notion of probability distribution and show that you get a density matrix, and then talk a bit about that idea of what a density matrix is. So the way you build this relation corresponds to a non-commutative algebra. You take non-commutative algebra, you form a diagram, which is where the vertices are all the commutative subalgebras. And the morphisms are inclusions. And there are also some variations on this, but I'll talk about that. So I'll just talk about the simple case of the spectral presheaf. So you have this diagram of commutative subalgebras and inclusions. And because these are all commutative subalgebras, by Galfoyan duality, they're also geometries. They're also topological spaces. So you can actually apply any topological construction to this diagram. So if I have some functor from top to C, so this is very general, any sort of functor, this is how we express the idea of what a classical concept is. We can then apply that function to the whole diagram, and then we get the same diagram, except now the vertices, instead of being topological spaces, they're valued in C. But now they're some diagram where all the vertices are objects in C. And then we can apply some limit or Kolmogorov universal property to this diagram to get a single object in C. right? So this takes us from an algebra to C, when our original function just went from topological space to C. And in the case, and with this recipe, whenever our algebra A was commutative, it's actually going to be the this exact same functor. So this is actually an extension. This is taking a topological functor, which is the same thing as a functor on commutative space algebras, and extending it to non-commutative case automatically, algorithmically, in a way such that when A is commutative, we haven't changed the functor at all. So this genuinely extends any topological concept to a non-commutative geometric concept. So some simple examples of what happens if you just take the identity functor from topological spaces. Well, you get something which gives you a spectrum, or in the commutative case, and an empty space in the non-commutative case. And this is basically the Kochi-Shpekar theorem. This is another way of stating the Eschenbutterfield formulation of the Kochi-Shpekar theorem. I think a more interesting one, which is new and probably more interesting for this audience, is what happens if you take the functor from topological space to convex sets, which takes in any topological space and gives you the convex set of the space of all probability distributions on that space, right? So that's like taking a classical state space to the convex set of all mixed states. What happens if you apply this algorithm to that? Well, you're going to get the functor which assigns to any one Neumann algebra its convex set of all positive linear functionals in norm one, i.e. the state space, when we talk about when the Neumann algebra is B of H, simply density matrices. So this is equivalent to Gleason's theorem, and I think it really gives an interesting picture of what quantum states are. I mean, I read, but yeah.
Sorry, I'm just a little bit confused about how you get the from the inclusion to the equal probabilities in different contexts. So I think there's something missing about what happens to the morphisms when you apply the Gelfand duality.
Oh, like how this thing works.
I mean, you can apply Gelfand duality to the objects there,
yeah.
but how then do you build the correspondence between the morphisms?
So you're asking what happens if I apply the Gelfand spectrum functor to this diagram? What happens to the inclusions?
Yeah, what do they turn into in the...
They turn into, so basically when you start with this, this commutative algebra of observables, you're going to get some spectrum into the outcome space. And what happens when these morphisms then become restrictions? Because the inclusions are like, there's fewer observables in here than there are in here. And then they go to, this is a richer outcome space than this one. And these, and this inclusion now becomes reverse, and it becomes a map going on to Murphy zeros. So if there are fewer observables here than there are here, then now an outcome in here restricts to an outcome in here by just forgetting about some observables. So when I'm going to have these outcome spaces, and I'm going to apply this functor to my distributions, and I'm going to get back the collection of quantum states. And this is basically Gleason's theorem, and it also gives a picture of what a quantum state is. I mean, I knew what a density matrix was. I'd read about Gleason's theorem. I knew, extending valuations of projections to a whole state, but I didn't quite get it until I saw it this way, and it made more sense to me about what Gleason's theorem is actually saying a state is. So when you look at it this way, it's like a probability distribution at every context, which is like every observable or every way of measuring an observable. So it's basically saying that if you have a co-distribution for every experiment you can do, right, and they're consistent such that if you do a more coarse-grained measurement, you can recover that co-distribution by simply averaging over a more refined experiment. That's a simple condition, that's all you need. If you have a distribution for every experiment you can do, and it obeys this condition where coarse-grained measurements, the data from that can be computed from the more refined one just by marginalization, by averaging, then that actually comes from a quantum state, because you need quantum state, which gives you that data. That's what Bootstrap is saying. So I'll go over that in a much more simple way that doesn't involve anything involving functors, category theory, or spectra, just in the most basic way possible. So suppose we have some algebra of observables for some quantum system that will represent the system by S, and this is a non-commutative algebra of observables, some subalgebra of B of H. And so say we have some set C of compatible observables. Yes. So this is going to be a collection of observables which can be measured simultaneously. So in the normal quantum mechanical formalism, that means that they all commute. So going to interpret these C, this D set C, so they're called contexts, and I'm going to interpret them as measurement procedure. So they're not just question of observables, they're also what else is being measured with it, and that's sort of specifies how you're measuring them. So there's a difference between when you measure position together with spin up or position with spin left. Now, because these represent procedures, we can actually complete this. So when we measure the observables in C, we're also simultaneously measuring the sums and products of everything in C, because we can just measure those by measuring the individual quantities and just taking the sum of them. Because they're all commutative, I mean, nobody disputes that if you have compatible observables, that when you measure them, you're also measuring the closure under addition and sum. You're measuring all the polynomials, actually. So we might as well assume that this is a subalgebra. So it makes sense. We're not making any physical assumptions by saying that when we measure a collection of compatible observables, we're actually measuring all the observables in the commutative subalgebra generated by that set. Okay? So here, C is a commutative subalgebra of our quantum system represented by S. So for every context C, we're going to construct this, what I call a contextual state space, which is all the outcomes, all the possible outcomes which occur when you perform an experiment measuring all the observables in C. And these are simply defined as all field value functions on observables. But they also have to respect addition and multiplication, because that's what we would expect for compatible observables.
What do you mean by real value functions on observables?
But this real value function is self adjoint elements in the real set algebra.
Maybe you go on, I'm not sure.
I mean, it's a Galton spectrum. It's just.
So these are the Galton transforms?
No, it's exactly the thing as the Galton spectrum. It's just.
The functions do not form the Galton spectrum.
Yeah,
the states form the Galton spectrum. But
these are the states.
But states are not all revalued functions and observables. You have positive linear functions of norm one.
That is a commutative.
The moreover are multiplicative.
My point is that these are states, that outcomes and states are conflated in this when we're looking at. First of all, it's a mathematical equivalent to the Galois spectrum, because because it's on observables, which is self-contained elements, you can complete that to the entire algebra and then become a complex value functions, which respect.
Okay, that's not my problem. My problem is rather this all R value functions. We certainly not want to look at all.
Yeah, the ones that respect addition multiplication. These are characters.
Characters, okay. Well, I know you know what you're talking about.
Yes.
It's just a bit confusing, this formulation. It's pure states of C. That's much more informative.
But the point is that when you phrase it this way, the analogy to classical state space becomes much clearer, because classical state space are real value. You have a bunch of points which represent the states.
Yes.
And then the observables are real-life functions on those guys.
Yes, but now you talk about real-life functions on observables.
Yeah, exactly. Those are states.
I do understand.
That's
how
duality works. You map to the same thing by.
Okay, go on. I think it's all the best on your formula.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if this is what's bothering you, but one of the things that's bothering me is the kind of apples and oranges problem. But I can define a real function which consists of all square of position plus the time that some other event happened plus the charge on some other object, and that's a real value function, but it's kind of nonsensical, especially if I'm not paying attention to my units. Right? I mean, there's a general principle when you're in the dimensional analysis, when you introduce that as an undergraduate, there are certain functions that just don't occur in nature because they violate the rules of dimensional analysis, right? And very useful when you can't remember formulae, which is something I often have trouble with. The dimensions add up. And so that would be a restriction on what your real value functions can be. You're not allowed things to just violate dimensional analysis or are otherwise ridiculous.
Yeah, but that would, I think that would show up in compatibility. But you wouldn't be able to add position and momentum together because they wouldn't show up in any of these contexts together.
Why?
Because they're not compatible with quantum mechanics.
Well, X plus P. In an observable, you can measure just not with X or with P.
Yeah, you suppress some constants when you run that down, but yeah, it's another one.
No, he's saying there's no context that contains X and P.
Sure.
So you can't find a C in which you would form X plus P.
Right.
Other than X plus P.
Yeah.
But I mean, that number
yeah.
still exists as a formal object.
Right, but ladder operators are not observables, right? You can do all sorts of things with ladder operators and they're very useful piece of kit, but they're not observables.
I think this is Babayel saying anything. So the argument, of course, should be that the observables in C look like functions on some classical state space on the Galfoin spectrum. Your O of C is this Galfoin spectrum.
But yes, but it's actually. So I mean, the way it's defined is there's some outcome space, right? Because each of these, every element, little O, in here. Represents an outcome of what happens if I measure the observable in C using the measurement procedure represented by the context. And the outcome is going to be something that gives you a number for every observable in there.
But then you're in trouble because, of course, you can scale. You take any observable, there's some momentum spectrum. You can scale it on an arbitrary real number, which is another.
Yeah, but it respects it. But if it's
so all the possible outcomes are the whole real line. You always get the full real line. That's not what you mean.
No, the function is the outcome, not the numbers. The actual assignment of numbers to observables is the outcome.
Yes, but that is not what physicists normally call the outcome. This is a value assignment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Physicists mean by outcomes mean real numbers, sometimes numbers with units. Yeah. Units are a murky question when you talk about operator algebras, it's always an interesting.
I mean, this is literally an outcome in the sense of like, probability theory, where you have a measure space and the outcomes are the points and the subsets are events.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what you mean,
okay.
But
There's another issue of, I mean, if you measure something, which is perhaps also related to what you just said, if I measure something like position, right, that's not, what I actually get is, you know, it's in a certain interval, it's in a finite interval, rather than being, it's exactly this position to infinite position.
Mm-hmm.
And how does your formalism capture that?
Well, I guess you would represent it as a distribution over, over possible outcomes for position.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have like
something that'll be an open set, right?
Or maybe another way would be, well, if I'm only trying to narrow it to an interval, then I have some coarse grained measurement which has a finite spectrum. So the space would be finite, so you'd actually just be picking one point. But you'd have some observable who's that only has, if you're doing a coarse grained measurement, then yeah, and then you could turn this, you could consider an observable who is that only has a finite spectrum. Does that make sense?
You'll have probability measures on this space now, right? So
yeah.
You can interpret this as being sort of the measure of an open set, an
yeah.
open interval that would be sort of the probability of lying within these intervals.
Mm-hmm. I mean this is all equivalent to normal Hilbert space formalism. Exactly, you would have the same problem. Like you wouldn't have. So basically, what you're saying is you wouldn't have a pure state of position as an outcome. You would have a density. You would have a distribution on position.
The actual. This is what Lockley says. If you're now defining as like on the classical sample space for the observables in C, and then states become measures on that space, and these measures need not be point measures, and in some situations they will not be point measures, like for position. One measure will actually say it's this exact position, and there may not exist point measures on a particular context, particular sample spaces.
Shall we debate this at the end, just
yeah.
so that we keep it?
Yeah.
Sort of,
right, so we defined the points of this the set of outcomes as being real value functions of the observables in C. But also, the observables in C, the quantities, they also define functions on this space by this equation. That's stuff on duality. So, because I defined the outcomes to be real value functions on the elements, on the observables, and we can now, therefore, for any observable, we can define a function on, we can have. Write a function q from the set of outcomes to R, and in fact every continuous function from every continuous function of this form every continuous function is of this form for some observable in C. So now we see why this is actually a classical state space, because we have some points, a collection of points, and the observables are represented as real value functions on that set of points. So this is a classical state space for the observables in C. And this guy here is interpreted as what happens if I measure the observable Q on a state O. So here we see that because we're in this classical setting, we can conflate the notion of state with outcomes. Right? So the point of that was to define, to motivate this construction OC, which is a set of outcomes for a context. And and to show that actually it's a classical, it's exactly formally analogous to a classical state space. So if we have some quantum state, which is a quadrilinear function of norm 1 on the algebra of the rules, then this actually gives us a bubble distribution for every bubble distribution on all of these outcome spaces. And that's, you do that by simply restricting this functional to create a subalgebra. And the representation theorem tells us that this linear functional is actually represented as a bubbly measure on this space. So given a quantum state rho, that actually gives us a probability measure on the outcome space for every context. And furthermore, this gives us a family of probability measures indexed by all the contexts. And these probability measures are consistent in the sense that I'll describe. They're consistent in the sense that if you have one context containing another, so that this context just contains fewer variables than this one. So you might say that this suggests a more refined measurement because it's just expecting the value of more compatible observables. Then, so we're going to have a probability measure in the quantum state here and one here, right? But this is just a more coarse-grained version of this measurement. So we should expect that this probability measure can be computed from this one simply by averaging over this bubble distribution. So whenever we have this one context containing another, then this bubble distribution can be computed from this one by marginalization. So this is true for any quantum state. Proof is not too hard, but I probably won't go over it now. So what I'm going to call a family of probability distributions which are indexed by context, consistent whenever this holds, whenever one context can another, that this distribution can be obtained from this one by marginalization. So the point is that every quantum state gives you a consistent family of probability distributions. And so vice versa, Gleason's theorem is basically saying that whenever you have a consistent family of probability distributions indexed by context, and that comes from a unique quantum state. So this condition can be understood in a number of ways. So one way is, as I mentioned before, that if you have a coarse-grained measurement, that you should be able to recover distribution in a simple way. This is also a generalization of no signaling, because if you have two parties, say, Alice has these variables, can perform AI on her site, and Doc can perform EJ on his site, then there are contexts which contain, because these are separated, and we know that variables in here are compatible with ones in here, so they exist in some context together. So that means whatever Bob measures, the distribution he gets cannot depend on whatever Alice measures, because no matter what Alice measures, the distribution is always the same, because it's obtained by marginalization. It's just simply the one that occurs when Bob measures something and Alice does nothing. But I mean, I think everybody here is quite familiar with my relation being nothing of itself. Don't need to stress that. Right, so I guess the last point that I wanted to make about this stuff was that whenever you have some family public distributions, Gleason's theorem says that you can reconstruct a linear quantum state. So originally it's in terms of Gleason's theorem is given in terms of probabilities for elementary events, and this is sort of same sort of thing, but it's saying that empirical data for every measurement together with the procedure it determines a quantum state. And the only condition on a family, if you have empirical data for every measurement you can do, the only thing that you need to know about it in order to reconstruct the quantum state is that that they obey this marginalization condition. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Thanks for this. It's nice, but I'm sorry I told you in person, and I've done all these things, and they're actually written down in papers. So this is not new. This is in papers, basically, already in the Kocher-Specker paper from 2004. This pre-sheaf of probability measures is there. It's explicitly said in Gleason's theorem. Basically, you get problem states give you global sections, but you can't get these global sections to point measures. More explicitly, in the quantum states as measures in the central pre-sheaf, there's this, and exactly this pre-sheaf you're talking about is in this paper from last year. So it's all correct, and I like this stuff, but it's not new. So when you write this up, this should be made clear, there should be added something to it. It's a nice perspective, and this is putting together these local, classical probability distribution to something global. Also showed up in my talk on Tuesday. So, I think what's powerful in your approach is this functorial perspective. Take any functor and do something with it. And this is something you should develop a bit more. Because I think that there can be much more learned from this. These things here are also. Rather than maybe extending this to PVMs would be one step that's doable, and the same techniques should apply.
Any other points? All right. Thanks for this.